They should have known. They'd been warned. They moved into the new territory that they possessed, and they didn't really do all that God had told them to do. And as they settled down in their new communities, down the street, across the road, were some of the Canaanites that they had been told to totally run out of their territory. And by and by, as time passed, they got to know them. And some of them they liked. They, by the standards of the world, weren't necessarily bad people. But they had different beliefs and different understandings. But, you know, they're pretty good neighbors. You know, my donkey got out and my Canaanite neighbor brought it back home to me. So, you know, he's a pretty good guy. Yeah, they've got some strange worship things that they do. And they don't worship the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but they're really not all that bad. And time passes, and one day we'll go have dinner at their house, and another day we'll invite them over to our house to have dinner. And as we talk, we find out that the basic principles of life are the same for them as they are for us. And, you know, we can draw some parallels even between their worship and our worship, and they're not such bad people. And my daughter's getting of marriageable age, and they've got a very wealthy and eligible son, so why not arrange a match? And by the same token, their daughters are pretty. Why not arrange a match with my son? And pretty soon, the worship of Yahweh and the worship of Baal starts getting a little confused. And elements of one begin to infiltrate the other, and elements of the other infiltrate the other one. And pretty soon, you have a situation in the land of Israel where the idols are erected on God's ground, even in the temple. And as it turns out, instead of us rubbing off on them, it appears that they've rubbed off on us a whole lot more, because some of their things are a little more attractive to the flesh than some of God's rules and regulations and ordinances. And pretty soon, we're not really sure what belongs and what doesn't belong, because the two have become so intertwined that there's very little difference to us from going over to the temple of God and going up to the high places, not to tear the devil's kingdom down, as we sang, but to sacrifice to the Baals, to sacrifice to Asherah. How did it happen? One slow, tiny step at a time. Start with Exodus chapter 34 this morning. In Exodus 34, start at verse 10 and read through verse 16. And he said, "Behold, I make a covenant. Before all your people, I will do marvels such as have not been done in all the earth nor in any nation." It's God speaking. "And all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Lord. For it's an awesome thing that I will do with you. Observe what I command you this day. Behold, I'm driving out from before you the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite." Stop there for a second. Behold, I make a covenant. God is making a covenant with his people that he'll do marvels that have never been seen, so that all the people among whom you are, that's all those folks that aren't us, that are the outsiders, that are the people of the world, will see the work of the Lord. So one thing that Israel is called to do as they come into the land of the promise and as they take possession is they're supposed to live in a godly fashion so God can deal mightily with them and marvelously with them and miraculously with them, so all of them out there can see. All of these lost people, all these people that aren't part of the commonwealth of Israel, are supposed to be able to look at Israel and see the glory of God and see what it looks like when a living God is among a people who are dedicated to God. That was part of the calling of the nation of Israel. Then he goes on in verse 12, "Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you are going, lest it be a snare in your midst." Anybody ever do any trapping? Anybody ever make a snare? The whole idea is it's concealed. It's a trap. It's there. It's in a place that you go. If you're going to try to snare a wild rabbit, you put the snare on the game trail, right where it normally goes. Oh, there's a path. Okay. Let's put the snare right there because the rabbit will be there. And then you conceal it so that your prey doesn't know that it's there. And then pretty soon, Mr. Bunny is hopping along doing his business, doing what bunnies do, looking for something to eat. And next thing he knows, he's got a wire around him and he's had. See, God says to the people of Israel that if you make a deal with the people who are not followers of God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it will be a snare for you. It's a trap that you don't see coming. And you put it right there where you're normally going to be traveling so that you have, hey, I was down this path yesterday and it worked fine. But now all of a sudden I'm caught. What happened? A snare was placed there. But you shall destroy their altars and break their sacred pillars and cut down their wooden images. For you shall worship no other god, for the Lord whose name is jealous is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods, and make sacrifice to their gods, and one of them invites you to eat of his sacrifice. To eat of something sacrificed to an idol is to partake in the worship of that idol. And you take of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters play the harlot with their gods, and make your sons play the harlot with their gods. This is exactly what happened to Israel. See, this is in Exodus. This is before they've entered into the land of the promise. This is before the generation that was going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years dies out. And God warns them exactly what they will do. I think, at least I'd like to hope, that I would be smart enough to know that if God says, John, there's a snare right there between the first row chairs of the middle aisle of this church, and it's likely to catch you, I would like to think anyway that I'd be smart enough to exit by one of the side aisles instead of walking into the area where the snare is. But that presupposes a couple of things. It presupposes that I know what God said and that I believe what God said. And if God says there's a snare there, then maybe I ought to avoid the place where the snare is. But the people of Israel, see, they probably started out with good intentions, but then it became normal daily life. And that Canaanite family down the street became no different than their Jewish neighbor next door, and they didn't pay that much attention to the differences, and they started to merge their lives together in spite of the instructions from God that says, hey, that's dangerous, you might not ought to do that. You know when that started, by the way, in the conquest of the Promised Land? Almost at the very beginning. If you read the book of Joshua, you find the story of Jericho. You find the story of Ai. And then you find this strange story that's played out in chapter 9 where this group of people looks at it and they see what God did with the Israelites across the Jordan. And they see what God did for the Israelites at Jericho. And they said, we got a problem. These guys are going to kill us all. Let's deceive them. Let's get old clothes on and get ourselves dusty and dirty and not bathe for a while and look like we've been on a long journey. And then we'll go to them and pretend that we're not one of their neighbors. We're from afar off. And we've heard of the glories of what their God has done and we want to make a covenant with them. And then when they figure out that we actually live here, they'll be bound by their covenant. So people called the Gibeonites. Stories in Joshua chapter 9. And basically they play this out. And there is this wonderful little caveat, this little side passage in Joshua 9 that says they didn't consult God first. They took the people at face value. They believed what they said. You know, their wineskins had been patched up and their clothes were dirty and ripped and they looked like they'd been on a long journey. And everything they said seemed right, but it was deception. It was the devil's way of entering into an agreement. And by the way, this deal that Joshua and the elders of Israel made with the Gibeonites, pretty soon it was found out. But then they said, but we made covenant. We can't break covenant but you people deceived us. You're going to be water gatherers and woodcutters for the people of Israel forever. And they said, we'll take that deal. It beats getting killed. Years and years and years and years later, Saul breaks that covenant with the Gibeonites and tries to destroy them. That covenant that was made was still in force. And Israel became a covenant breaker and suffered great loss because of it. Because God said, hey, y'all made a deal. You got to honor your deal. And now you've turned on them. And, you know, retribution has to happen. So, the people of Israel, it started, like I said, almost immediately. Numbers also recounts a similar situation here. In Numbers chapter 33, God's instructions for the conquest of Canaan, starting in verse 50 of Numbers 33. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you have crossed the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, destroy all of their engraved stones, destroy all of their molded images, and demolish their high places. You shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land and dwell in it, for I have given you the land to possess. And you shall divide the land by lot as an inheritance to your families. Skipping down to verse 55. But and therefore. When you run into but and therefore in the Scripture, back up and figure out what it's there for. Because basically it's a cause and effect. If you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall be that those whom you let remain shall be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall harass you in the land where you dwell. Moreover, it shall be that I will do to you as I thought to do to them. Now, Moses said this early on in Exodus, and one of the later things that we find in the account of the life of Moses is this part of Numbers, where he says near the end of the road again, when you all go in to Jordan, when you cross the river and go into the land of the promise, be sure not to have social dealings with the people of the land, because there'll be a snare. There'll be a stumbling block. I'll take you back now, actually. I'm going to go to a different place. I'm going to go to the first chapter of Judges. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I want you to scan it with me just a minute. Because it is a painful story of disobedience. Remember, get rid of all of them, right? Because if you don't, there'll be a snare. There'll be a thorn in your side. That's going to be a problem. You're going to end up having social dealings with them, and it's going to bring about disaster. But if you start looking in Judges 1 and start scanning down, we'll find over here, let's look in verse 19. So the Lord was with Judah, and they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. We come on down. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. And we come on down. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Bethshean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Eblim and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and the villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Kenites who dwelt in Gezer. Nor did Zebulon drive out the inhabitants of Kitron and the inhabitants of Nahal. Or the Canaanites dwelt, so the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. Put under tribute. We'll let you stay if you pay us off. You bring us some of your crops and some of your gold, and we'll let you stay. Sounds like a covenant to me. We made a deal. Y'all can stay if you pay us. So, during this time that Israel was supposed to possess the land of the promise, and the reason that they were supposed to possess it and drive out all of these foreign powers was the religious and social influence of the foreigners, God knew that it would rub off on Israel and would pervert Israel, and even their worship would be skewed and changed into something that looked more Canaanite than it looked worship of Yahweh. And this is exactly what happened. Well, John, that was thousands of years ago in Israel. What in the world does that have to do today? We live amidst the foreigners too. And I don't mean that in a physical sense, in a racial or ethnic or country of national origin sense. I mean that in this way, that we are supposed to be the followers of Jesus Christ. We are supposed to be the children of God, brothers, co-heirs with Christ, a kingdom of priests. We're supposed to be that chosen people in this day and bring about the influence of God into a world that needs Him. And that all sounds good. The problem is we live in the midst of a world that doesn't share those values. The problem is not the world out there, because we're in the world and we can't get out of it until such time as God calls us home or until the Lord returns. So the problem is not the world outside the church. The problem is the marriage covenant the church has made with the world. You see, we've invited the Canaanites in so many ways. Look at the struggles that the churches across the world are having today. Look at the worldly philosophies and attitudes that have not just been in our communities around our churches, but have made their way into the pews and, yes, into the pulpits of churches. Am I saying that we should be exclusionists like the Israelites were and kill all those Canaanites out there? No. That's not what we're called to do in this day and age. But what we're called to do is not to enter into covenant with the world. We're not supposed to let the altar of Baal be erected in the temple of Yahweh. And that is first and foremost in your heart. When we get too close to the world, when we start making covenants and deals and compromises with the world, when we start letting the world pay tribute to us to stay in our territory, when we know God said no, then we've got a problem. Jesus did address this. In John 17, Jesus prays for the church. He prays for the followers that He had in that day, and He prays for the church all the way up till today and tomorrow until the Lord comes back. And in John 17, verse 9 says this, talking about those that God has given Him. I do not pray for the world, but for those whom You have given Me, for they are Yours. Jesus recognizes that God has given us to Him to shepherd. And all Mine are Yours, and Yours are Mine, and I'm glorified in them. Jesus says, prophetically speaking, because at that moment He is in the world, but He's very soon not going to be. I'm no longer in the world, but these are in the world. And I come to You, Holy Father, keep them through Your name, those whom You've given Me, that they may be one as We are one. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in Your name. Those who You gave Me I have kept, and none of them is lost except the son of perdition, that the Scripture might be fulfilled. That, of course, is Jews. But now I come to You, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have My joy fulfilled in themselves. Listen to this. I have given them Your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not pray that You should take them out of the world, but that You should keep them from the evil one. They're not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by Your truth. Your word is truth. As You sent Me into the world, I have also sent them into the world. It's very plain that we are living in the world. And all you got to do is look around you to see it. But we're not supposed to be of the world. We are supposed to be separate. We are supposed to be holy. We are supposed to influence what goes on out there more than what's out there influences us. Yes, the world is going to worship the gods of this world, but we as the church cannot worship the gods of this world. We cannot let the philosophy of the world infiltrate into the walls of the church. Now, what do you mean, John? You mean sinners can't come in and hear the gospel? That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is this, that those worldly philosophies, those worldly ideas of what is right and proper, I mean, we've even gotten to the point now that people can question their biological gender and it's protected for them to be able to do that. When those philosophies get in the heart of the people who are the church, then the church has erected the altar of Baal in the temple of Yahweh. And we are liable for judgment and consequences, just like Israel was. You see, Israel was supposed to be a city set on a hill, a light to the nations. It was supposed to be this beacon of what a people wholly dedicated and devoted to God could look like. It was supposed to be a society that was not perfect, but was just about as close as it can be. It was supposed to be that because God's influence was in them, and God's influence was supposed to shine out into the world. And the light dispels darkness, and darkness, you know, can't overcome the light. Well, that is part of the calling of the church. You know, the church does not replace Israel. We are grafted into the tree. We're grafted into the olive tree. Paul tells us that. And the picture is this, that we get to draw from the richness of the root. The richness of the root is, you know, the root connects the tree to the source. The source is God. The trunk of that tree and the root is that structure and that truth that God delivered first to the children of Israel and has been recorded for us, the truth of the Old Testament, so that we understand about creation and we understand about innocence and we understand about sin and we understand about substitutionary sacrifice. We understand the truth of what holy living looks like. That's the richness of the root, that connection to God, and that ability for God's truth to just flow up through the root that has been preserved for us in this book and get to us so that we understand the whys and wherefores. We understand what God likes and what He hates. And we are grafted into that to bear fruit. The function of the branch is to bear fruit. The branch doesn't produce the fruit. The branch doesn't, it's not directly connected to the source. It's connected to the trunk, which is connected to the root, and it draws from the source. But that same mission that Israel had, to be a light to the nations, to be a city set on a hill, to be that beacon of safety and wholeness and healing and right and good, is the mission of the church. And we can't be that holy light if we become polluted with the things of the world. What does that look like? That looks like devotion, to spend time with God, to listen to what God has to say, to be more concerned about God's truth than about what your neighbor thinks, to be more concerned about what is right and what is holy and what is righteous than what is popular. We live in a society today that tells you that what the book says is wrong is right, and that we are wrong if we don't buy into it. That's what our world's telling us. There are lights. There are those who will stand up and say, no, that right's right and wrong's wrong, and this might be the popular opinion, but it doesn't agree with the truth of God, therefore even though it's popular, it's wrong, and you get vilified for it, and you get separated for it. But what happens when we compromise with the world? Got a bottle of nice clear water here. How much dirt would I have to put in it before it didn't look like it was too appetizing to drink? How much dirt would I have to put in it before it became harmful for me to drink it? See, it doesn't take much, does it? When the church, and I'm talking about, let's skinny the church down to its smallest unit. You know, the smallest unit in our body is a cell. The smallest unit in the church is that church that is in my heart and your heart individually. When we start getting too much of the world in the church, it stinks. You know, we've had a lot of storms go through the country recently, and, you know, yeah, I bet you could go down to Louisiana and Texas now and find pools of filthy, stagnant water with green, slimy stuff growing in it and an oily film on top of it and mosquitoes breeding in it. There was nothing wrong with that water when it fell out of the sky, but it sat there and stagnated and it got stuff in it, and now it stinks and now it's harmful and now it's dangerous. God told Israel that when they allowed the Canaanites to remain in their midst, that it was dangerous, that it would be polluted, that it would stink, that it would cause harm. And when we let the philosophies of the world get into us, we stink and are dangerous and are harmful. Now, having said that, what is dangerous and harmful are not the people, but it is the misunderstanding, the deception, the work of Satan, the sin that is in the world is the problem. It's not the people. We've got to learn to love the people and defeat the sin. What I said in the beginning, I called back to that statement that I put on the internet there, that it's all about redemption, not retribution. It's not, hey, person, you're in sin, I'm going to vilify you as junk and throw you out with last week's garbage. That's not it. It's, hey, person, you've been deceived. You've bought into a lie. I've got some truth here from the Creator of the universe that can change your life. I can't agree with what you're doing. I can't agree with the philosophy you're preaching. But I've got to tell you this. This is the truth. This is from God. This is from Christ. And it's for your benefit. Won't you please take it? Some will. And others won't. And it's up to us. Connie, you've been feeding a stray cat. You kept putting that food out until the cat was comfortable enough to come up on the porch and eat it. It didn't turn it down once and you said, forget that. How often do we offer Christ to that person who's rejected Him time and time and time again? We don't throw people. We're supposed to be long-suffering as God is long-suffering. That doesn't mean that I need to be in misery every day of my life for all of my life. That doesn't mean that I need to inflict pain upon myself as some radicals will try to do so they can suffer like Jesus. Long-suffering means patient. I'll keep offering and I'll keep offering and I'll keep offering and I'll keep offering. How long? As long as it takes. How many times have you said no to God? On the first time and the second time and the 45th time and the 145th time, and weren't you glad that He offered it to you the 146th time when you finally took it? The church doesn't need to make lost people feel uncomfortable in themselves, but the church must make them uncomfortable with their sin. Not devaluing the person, but explaining why the sin hurts, why it is harmful, why it is poison. Then we can reach people. We don't throw people out, man. Can't do that. Jesus later in that prayer in John 17 says to us, you know, he's speaking now not to those that are of His generation, but to those who will become believers through what they say. And that, by the way, is a daisy chain that keeps going. It started 2,000 years ago. And it's continuing today. The people that are going to hear this in this room and on the internet and whatever, they are people who are hearing the gospel message from the disciples. It's carried on generation by generation by generation. God forbid that a single generation should be silent, because the message dies if a generation is silent. It says to them, that they all may be one as You, Father, are in Me and I in You, that they may also be one in Us, that the world may believe You sent Me. That's the goal. The goal is that the world believe in what Jesus did. That the world believe that there is something wonderful and freeing and life-changing in Him. And they'll never get that message if they don't see life changing in us. And if we let the Canaanites erect their altars in our temple, then they're seeing a polluted vision. There's two racks of spotlights back in the back of this sanctuary. If we were to turn all the lights off and turn those spots on, we might see a yellow light and a red light and a green light. They're all white bulbs. They've got filters in front of them that make them seem to be a different color. The Christ in us needs to shine through pure and white and spotless, uncolored by the filter of John, uncolored by the filter of Bruce or the filter of Zeta. They need to see Christ in us. And the more of the world that remains, the more muddied and polluted that light looks. And it's no longer white because we've colored it with something that's impure. Now it's critical. it's important that although we are in the world, we cannot be of the world. We need to influence the world, and the world cannot be allowed to influence us. Now, there are pressures out there every day. There's several of you out there who are in the workplace, and there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of people around you. You may be working with godly people, and you may be working with ungodly people. You may be working with other Christians, and you may be working with people of any of a number of the world religions. And you're going to find that some of those are good people, and they're nice people, and they're friendly, and you want to have social interaction with them. Just be sure that you influence them more than they influence you. Don't bring those worldly perspectives and those worldly ideas and those false religion idols into your heart. You shine the light. Don't let the light, their light, which is a false light, shine into you. Yeah, that's a different tone today, isn't it? It's not. Those kinds of messages are sometimes hard to hear. But what we've got to do is we've got to back up and look. And we've got to see how much of the world's thinking has infiltrated into us. We hear it over and over and over. We hear it in the news media. We see it in our entertainment venues. We hear it at the water cooler 6 feet apart. But we hear it. And it just keeps coming. And if we're not real careful, some of it will get in. I remember when I had my knee surgery some years ago, one of the first things I wanted to do was get a shower, you know, when I kind of got back to things. And I remember taking a roll of Saran Wrap, a product that was invented by Satan himself. I remember taking that Saran Wrap and making about 4 or 5 rounds around, and then took some adhesive tape and put a nice tight band around the top of it. And you know what happened when I got out of the shower? It was wet inside there anyway. Point is, no matter how much care you take, sometimes it seeps in. Now I'm not talking about the shower water. Now I'm talking about the philosophies of the world. How many in this room watch or listen to the news or turn on their Facebook feed and see something that makes you so mad you can't see straight? The world's sneaking in. We need to know what's going on. We need to be aware. We need to be informed. We need to know how to, in this election season, we need to know how to cast a vote. We need to know those things because we do have to live in Hazard, in Perry County, some of us not county. We have to live here, and we have to be a part of this society. So we need to know what's going on. But we got to guard our heart. We've got to guard our core. We've got to guard our belief system. And we got to go back and not look at what my neighbor's doing, but look at what God says in His Word and say, is my belief system in tune with God? Or is my belief system in tune with the world? Is my attitude preaching at myself now. Is my attitude in tune with God, or is it in tune with the world? Am I looking at it like, gee, that person who appears to be my enemy is actually someone I need to reach for Jesus, or do you want to stuff them in an auger hole somewhere? We've got to do that because it sneaks in. Just like that water under that Saran Wrap, it sneaks in. And it's a constant, ongoing filtering process. If you want to drink filtered water, you don't just filter it for one day and then let the filter get dirty and never change it. Because by and by, the filter's dirtier than the water was. Stand with me. This isn't one of them jumping and shouting messages. This is a pull out the mirror and look inside your heart message. And I'm going to ask every one of you to do that right now. Start thinking about your words and your attitudes. Think about how much of the world's quote truth that you have incorporated into your belief system. See, that's where it gets dangerous. That's where syncretism kicks in and we start merging things. I actually saw part of a quote from John Wesley on the internet this week, and it's a philosophy that I've always believed in. What we tolerate today, we'll end up embracing tomorrow. And then pretty soon after that, we will begin to endorse it. So if there is a particular issue in society that you first start out and you're totally against it, but you begin to just, it's worn me down. Those Canaanites aren't really such bad people after all. I'll just let them do their thing and I'll do mine and it'll be fine. Well, after a period of time, what they do begins to look less foreign and alien And by, you start getting closer and closer and closer to it. You start getting closer to what they do, and you start incorporating some of their thought into yours, because it wears you down. Because after all, they're not really bad people. They're folks just like us. Now, they believe different, but that's okay. I'll go have dinner with them. And by, it's worn on you so much that now you begin to believe what they believe and even promote it to other people. That's a process that Satan knows that we do not react well to 180-degree turns. But if he can walk beside us and bump us a little bit, get us off a little bit, and bump us again, get us off a little bit more, bump us again and get us off a little bit more, pretty soon we're going the wrong direction. It don't take much. If your compass is off 5 degrees, you'll eventually meet yourself. Think about it. So look inside. What have we let in that we should not have let in? Time to sweep it out. Get rid of it. Passover, they leave just a little bit of leaven in the house. So symbolically, Daddy can take the feather and brush that little bit of leaven out and take it outside the house. You know what he does with it? Burns it. Get rid of it. It can't come back if I burned it. It's got to go. We need to burn some stuff, folks.